Early Royal Navy Centimetric Radar Operations, The Short History of a Hanky Boy, an 18-minute presentation to the Defence Electronics History Society held at the Defence Academy, Shrivenham, on the 18th of October 2007. The presenter is Mr. Colin Latham, speaking on behalf of Philip Fox, who was unable to attend.
This is somebody else's paper. I've got the real paper here. I think it's a long, interesting paper. Could take an hour, or best of an hour, to go through completely, and I hope that Philip will do that one of these days. So I've made a kind of very, very abbreviated version of it in date order, which I hope to go through and give you some idea of the main points that he covers. Now, in this presentation, there are two themes that running together. One theme is the short but very eventful career of Philip Cox, and the other theme is the action in the Navy of the first microwave radar in the Navy, the Type 271. So the 271 and Philip Cox are the two main ingredients of this discussion. It starts in 1939. In 1939, when the war broke out, Philip Cox was just coming up to 17 years of age. He was a boy at public school, Rugby, and he was one of the boys who was asked if they'd care to take part in what was known as the Hanky Scheme. The proper title for this presentation is a Short History of a Hanky Boy. Now, hanky is nothing to do with hanky-panky. It's quite a different process altogether. You mustn't get confused on that. Very, very proper, all this. The situation is that the Hanky Scheme was a scheme whereby boys who were young, enthusiastic and keen on science could be given a bursary from the government, whereby they would go to university first of all, from school straight to university, take university instruction for about a year or something like that, or less than a year, then move into the services and get instruction in the new magic radar which was just being produced. He joined the Hanky Scheme, went to university, then was commissioned into the Navy, and then he did service in the Navy, and after coming out of the Navy at the end of the war, he survived it, fortunately, much to our surprise, and he then continued and got his degree at Queen's College, Cambridge. So that was the Hanky Scheme, a fine scheme. Switching now from Philip Cox to the radar itself. The radar was the Type 271, and the 271 is quite remarkable because it was doing trials in March 1941, which was just a little over a year since the magnetron had been first proven at Birmingham University. And in that short time, the very, very fundamental early magnetron was changed into a production design. And there in March 41, we had radars on trial with magnetrons. And the first 271 was fitted in a Flower-class Corvette, known as HMS Orcus. Similar, we believe, to this ship which is shown here. That's the kind of ship. Trials were done, and the trials were so successful in picking up submarines which were just on the surface or lurking under the surface, picking up a submarine from a little bit of a submarine that was just showing above the surface, including the periscope, that immediately an order was placed on Metropolitan Vickers for 1,000 sets. That was some confidence in microwave radar. The Navy already had radar on longer wavelengths, like 7 meters and so forth, but the jump from that wavelength down to 10 centimetres made all the difference, and suddenly radar became so essential and useful at sea. So that was March 41, 1,000 sets ordered from Metropolitan Vickers. Moving on to November 1941, a U-boat near Gibraltar was sunk by a 271 radar, and this further confirmed, well, it wasn't sunk by the radar, it was sunk by the torpedoes which were sent as a result of the radar detection, and this further confirmed the ability of microwave radar. By May 42, 230 ships had been fitted with Type 271, and they were corvettes and frigates and minesweepers and destroyers. Now, we've got some more pictures, I think. On the 271 itself, the power output of the transmitter was somewhere between 50 and 70 kilowatts. Quite a remarkable power at the time, not to be compared with the later radars that soon came along, but it was a useful power. You could get echoes at about 5,000 yards from surfacing submarines. And there's the antenna system of the 271, actually two aerials, one for transmitting, one for receiving. So no complication due to TR switching. The upper cheese is the transmitter, and the lower cheese is the receiver. And the transmitter, we'll see a picture of the transmitter presently, the transmitter itself is hanging on the back. Going down to the left, you can see the pulse transformer here. That's the magnet of the magnetron, and the magnetron itself is just there. You can see an engine on there. That's something else up on the top there. Looks like a capacitor to me. And I think that at the top of the picture, there's one or two valves, which are probably the first couple of IF stages, because they have the crystal mixer and the first two IF stages as a head amplifier. Then they're piping the IF signal down into the equipment underneath. Now, the equipment which is below decks, as it were, or on the deck, comes in the next picture. I'm told that these pieces of equipment here, which at the bottom you've got the power supply and the modulator, and then you've got the receiver, which of course is the klystron local oscillator, the oscillator being piped up by coax to the transmitter assembly at the top, and then the single display at the top, just an ordinary range tube. That's all it had. No PPI. Later sets did have PPIs, but on this fundamental set, everything was dead simple. And that was really one of the glories of the set, that there wasn't very much to go wrong, fortunately. One point about this is that I'm told that when these ships were made at Metropolitan Vickers, they were fitted in a kind of enclosure, which were known as huts. Funny word, a hut, to go on a ship. But these huts, apparently, enclosures, were prefabricated with this thing fitted inside, complete with ashtrays, incidentally, which is very curious. And the dimensions of the hut were transferred to the ship so that ships could be pre-drilled. These were ships, of course, already in service. They were not being fitted with radar until after they were put in service. And so the ships could be pre-drilled, and therefore, in the shortest possible time, the equipment could be taken on board, fitted to the deck, piped up to the aerial below, plug into the ship's mains at 500 cycles, and the other thing they had to couple up was the voice tubes, because the voice communications between the operator looking at the screen and the man on the bridge was done not by microphones and electronics, but done by audio speaking tubes in those days. So they coupled up the voice tubes as well. So there we are. Now we're moving on a bit further. These radars are fitted in a number of ships. But Phillips complaining that although they fitted 230 ships by 1942, there were only 50 ships in the naval convoy escorts, which he was involved in. Moving on 3 years from when the war started to September 42, at age 20, just 20, Philip Cox emerged from the radar training which he had at Portsmouth, and he was given the wonderful title, which I rather like, of temporary probationary acting sub-lieutenant, special branch, Royal Naval Voluntary Reserve. It seems in the Navy, the smaller the rank, the bigger the bigger the description. And what he points out, very interestingly, is as a commissioned officer, albeit he was a commissioned officer, he had a lovely wooden toolbox to take everywhere with him. So really, in a way, he was a kind of glorified radar mechanic. There's a commissioned officer who actually gets on the job. And in his toolbox, he had a soldering iron and an avometer and a Pyrotenax bending kit for bending the cables. So he was well equipped. Now, he was posted. As soon as he was appointed to this, he was posted to Rannoch in Scotland on the River Clyde. And that was the base for one of the North Atlantic escort groups, the group called B3. He really spent about 6 months there just working on different radars and dockside until something happened which caused him to go to sea for the first time. And that was in March 1943. In March 43, their particular convoy, an escort group, consisted of 10 ships, 4 destroyers and 6 corvettes. That particular group was bringing a load of merchant shipping back from the United States. They were all attacked. There was a great disaster. And HMS Harvester, which was the leading destroyer, was sunk. A lot of loss of life, a lot of merchant ships lost as well. And I'm told that in 1942, 5 million tons of merchant shipping was lost altogether. Now, because of this, there was a hasty move to go out and try and rescue the rest of the convoy that was there, so that for the first time he went to sea on a ship called HMS Keppel, and they went out to sea to the mid-Atlantic. By the time they got there, all the action had ceased, and so they really came back very peacefully. That was March 43, but by the end of May 43, it seems that attacks from U-boats were coming down a bit. The combined result of the 271 on various ships, plus the fact that the Air Force were taking out microwave radars. Together they were detecting submarines, and apparently Admiral Dönitz recalled all his U-boats at the end of 43 away from the North Atlantic. So it looked as though the U-boat menace was being won to some extent. But it wasn't really, because a little bit later on, in September 43, Dönitz decided to have another go. He'd sort of regrouped his U-boats, according to this paper, and fitted them with acoustic mines, or acoustic torpedoes, so that once they got in range of merchant ships, they could attack them, and they were doing so. So, for the second time, Philip Cox goes out to sea. Now, the first time he went out to sea, he was the acting radar officer for the whole of the convoy. Second time he went to sea, he was the radar officer, so he'd been promoted that little bit. But he was still, of course, a temporary probationary sub-lieutenant. Poor chap. But he had his wooden toolbox. Now, he went out in a ship called the Escapade, and that was one of the ships in the convoy. They went out into the mid-Atlantic, and they were attacked by U-boats all around, but they managed to get through. There's a lot of detail about these naval actions. If you see the whole paper, it's quite terrifying what went on. But nevertheless, they did get through. And then there was a problem, because he was told that on another boat on the convoy, called the Narcissus, HMS Narcissus, the radar had failed. He was on a different ship. So the point of the story is that the two boats had to go close together within a short distance in a very, very rough sea. He had to be taken in an open rowing boat with his toolbox across from one ship to the other, get to the other ship, ships going up and down. Under those conditions, he managed to find out, and I don't know how he did it, he managed to find that the pulse transformer on the 271 had failed. Now, I don't know how he actually... I had a bit to do with modulators. It's not always easy to tell when a pulse transformer was packed up, but he did. And he defined that it was the pulse transformer which had given the trouble, and he decided to take it apart and do the job. No workshop to do it, so he borrowed the captain's cabin, took the pulse transformer out of the transmitter here, got it on the captain's table, drained out the oil, unwound it, found a break in the windings, soldered it up together, and repaired the pulse transformer, put it back on the oil, did the thing, got it back, and it all worked. and he got the DSC as a result of this, and well done. He then goes on into a very long description, which is most interesting, of all the terrible things that happened at sea, burning ships, people in the water. And when I think about the people who win the Navy in the war, I think we had a pretty easy time in the RAF, as I did, quite different altogether. Take off my hat to them. Now, in March 44, he had a land posting, it was his last posting in the Navy, and he was posted to the ASC at Haslemere, the Admiralty Signals Establishment at Haslemere. And has a number of comments. He talks about the fact that they were getting information coming through that the Germans were developing new submarines with a new propulsion system using a mixture of diesel oil and hydrogen peroxide, which would improve the speed of the ships under the sea. They were also experimenting with a snorkel so that the ship could both breathe and exhaust while under the sea. And they were also experimenting a lot more with the acoustic mines. He is of the opinion, if the war had gone on, then it wouldn't have lasted very long because Germany would have won, there's no doubt about it. But fortunately, the stage of the war had been reached where, of course, the land forces were doing things and we were bombing, and altogether the tide of the war was turning. And so, fortunately, the German Navy was not able to exploit this particular attribute. He talks also about other radars. He talks about the 277, and he talks about the X-band 268, which is then just coming into use in the Navy. He also talks a lot in his paper about the fact that he feels that in the Navy, emphasis on security was overdone. We had security in the Air Force, but we had places in the Air Force where you could all talk about radar and get together. But maybe on the confines of a ship, the man who knew about radar, he himself as the radar officer, and one or two others, just a few other operators, it wasn't possible to talk about it very much because other people here, all the other people on the ship, shouldn't know anything at all about radar. And he says that this overemphasis on security was something which held radar back during the war, and many more U-boats, he thinks, could have been attacked had other people taken more interest in it. He goes on this. Whether this is true, I don't know, but that's the main point of the paper. And, of course, the lack of trained officers. He was one officer amongst 10 ships being transported from ship to ship as equipment broke down, although it was a pretty reliable radar. He says if they had more trained officers, then there would have been better operation. He was demobilised from the Navy in 1945, July 1945. He'd had enough of war, seen enough of bodies in the sea and ships on fire to not be interested in following a military career. So he returned to Cambridge and studied law. He did well studying law. He became a first-class barrister and a QC in due course. So he made his name in another field. I'd just like to add that the 271, which you see here, was also used in the RAF to some extent. It was also used in some of the coast-watching sets. There was the series AMES, Air Ministry Experimental Stations, 30 to 37, which were using the 271 as the basic radar. And then when the 277 came in, which was the much bigger, more powerful naval radar, 500 kilowatts power on 10 centimetres, that was the basis of the Air Force sets, types 50 to 57. One of the best books on radar history, in my view, is that by Louis Brown of the Carnegie Institute of Washington. And in his book, he makes comments about the 271. Three comments. He says, the 271 gained endearment from its ability to locate lifeboats at night or in fog. I think what an advantage that was. The development of the 271 went forward faster at the HM Signal School than it did at TRE for airborne radar because the radar seemed easy and sensible. That's his view of it. And then he says the British had, by 1941, almost a dozen different shipborne radars installed. It was not until the 271 appeared in March and April 41 that they had a surface search radar set competitive with the German ZTAC. I would say it was more than competitive because the ZTAC was on 50 or 60 centimetres. This was on 10 centimetres, and that's what made all the difference. So that briefly is that paper. I'm sorry I've stumbled through it as I have, but I hope you've got some of the feeling for it, and I hope that he'll be able to come and talk to you about himself in due course.
Mr. Latham was asked how the bearing was determined from a scanning radar which was displayed on an A-scope.
As far as I can make out, it was by turning the aerial, just DFing the aerial. Thank you.
Mr. Latham can be contacted by email at colin@latham55.freeserve.co.uk.